Hi, this is Corey Sierra from the Group Revealer. We're hanging out with WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Accra or anytime at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Art Omai, a sculpture and architecture park and international residency center in Ghent, New York. Open daily from dusk until dawn. Art Omai presents the work of contemporary artists and architects across 120 acres of field and forest. Information at artomai.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Pat Lanan of Hillsdale, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM, listener aided and abetted radio.
Take your Wellingtons off, children. And Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening, this is Kevin Factor and Foraging Ahead. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, I'd like to start with Humpty Dumpty. Not the nursery rhyme, though everybody knows it, right? Humpty Dumpty built a great wall. Humpty Dumpty made Mexico pay for it. Rather, I'd like to start with the Humpty Dumpty in Lewis Carroll's Alice Through the Looking Glass, and a short dialogue that captures the theme of today's show. "I don't know what you mean by glory," Alice said. Humpty Dumpty smiled contemptuously. "Of course you don't, till I tell you. I meant, there's a nice knockdown argument for you." "Glory doesn't mean a nice knockdown argument," Alice objected. "When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said, in a rather scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." "The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master? That is all." So we've got a bit of a Humpty Dumpty show. Not broken, though so much in this world seems to be broken at the moment, but in a postmodern crisis of meaning sense, which I suppose is also broken. But we're going to have fun with it anyway. First up, we're going to have a little radio play called Freedom with Caitlin Langstaff, Simon Ravensburger, and a couple of anonymous actors. And after the play, a discussion with two anonymous historians, Billy and Bob, who offer economic, political, social, and spiritual insight and context to this historical moment. But first, a young man returns home from college to quarantine with his family and discovers things aren't quite what he thought they were.
Mom! Mom! Stop!
Hey!
Hey, baby. You finished with your writing midterm, or am I making too much noise? I can wait till you're done.
It's medieval calligraphy, Mom. It's writing, but not writing. And it's not the noise. It's... I just wish you wouldn't do this.
I thought it was writing.
Technically, yes. But, Mom, can't you hold off on this?
It's supposed to rain tomorrow. Gotta make hay. You go finish your medieval Caligula technical writing, and don't worry about me. I can manage this on my own.
It's not that, Mom. Just please don't. Can't we call someone?
There's no one to call, darling. This isn't an essential service. Look, honey, I know you're upset, but we'll get through this.
Mom!
You know, I thought this might be a fun project for us, but whatever. I know being home is hard for you now, but you do you and your work, and I'll do mine, and we'll get through this.
Mom, you can't cremate the dog in the backyard.
What else are we supposed to do with Muffin?
Can't we just bury her? Or let Dad know?
This soil's too rocky for digging, sweetheart. It's going to rain tomorrow. You know there's no reception at the cabin. We won't hear from Daddy until he finishes his project. Are we supposed to just sit here and let her rot on the porch? What choice do I have?
Mom, there's got to be a little wiggle room between letting the dog rot on the porch and burning her in the backyard. Please, you can't!
Oh, you're really getting worked up about this. You can't do this, you can't do that. You sound just like the government.
This has nothing to do with the government, Mom.
Oh, honey, of course it's the government. Close the schools, close the shop, close the churches. You need a permit to turn around and take a poop these days. And if you do, there isn't any toilet paper. You might as well wipe your bottom with the Constitution for all it's worth now. Black Lives Matter and Antifa can burn down Democrat cities, but I can't honor the love of this animal that gave our family. I mean, how fair is that?
What about the neighbors?
Oh, baby, you can't worry about what other people think. You gotta worry about yourself first. That's just how this world works, darling. You'll learn. And besides, people have always burned their pets. It's just basic history. Don't they teach basic history at school?
I missed that class. Why don't you clue me in?
Okay. How about the Egyptians?
What?
When their king died.
You mean Pharaoh?
That's what I said. When a Pharaoh died, they'd burn his favorite dog so that he'd have pets in the afterlife.
That's nonsense, Mom.
How do you know? Were you there? Nobody was there, honey. Nobody really knows. But I bet the pharaohs didn't let some plague shut down their whole economy.
Why is this so important to you?
Why won't you support your own mother?
Because this is just wrong, Mom.
Right or wrong, a boy supports his mother. What about the Mexicans? In that movie, the little bug-eyed dog guided souls to the land of the dead.
Do you mean the Aztecs?
That's what I said. You listen, but you don't hear, sweetie.
What does that have to do with throwing Muffin on a bonfire?
They used to eat them, too, you know.
But they didn't roast them in the backyard!
So, they ate raw dogs? That's disgusting. Of course they cooked them. It was just like us throwing a pork chop on the grill, honey.
That's different, and you know it.
If we're gonna get through this, we have to stick together and do for ourselves. What about the Indians?
What about the Indians?
Not the woo-woo cowboy and Indian Indians. The other kind. The India Indians.
Yes, the Hindus do cremate their dead.
Is that what they want us to call them now?
So what's your point?
The point is freedom, Joey. Are you telling me that I have less freedoms as an American in America than a Pharaoh King of Egypt or some Aztec Mexicans or a Hindu India Indian? What about the Vikings?
You can't just make up history because, for some reason, you need to throw Muffin on a funeral pyre.
If enough people believe something happened, it happened.
Jesus Christ!
Joseph Jr. Did you call the police?
I'm sorry, but I had no choice.
It's Mackie. Hey, Mackie! Put that thing
Okay, Joe. Done.
I meant the mask.
You don't like it?
Oh, I do. It brings out the color in your eyes, but it covers up your beautiful smile.
Thanks. Tina made it for me. She's got one of those Etsy stores now. Hey, Joey, how's school?
Hey, Sheriff McKenzie. School's fine. We're finishing up remotely. Would you please tell my mom that she can't cremate the dog in the backyard?
Joey!
The kid's right, Joe. There's no way you can generate the heat with this pile of sticks to cremate anything more than a pork chop. It's going to take at least a half a quart of hardwood to get the 95,000 BTUs you'll need to properly incinerate a dog this
size. Don't we at least need a permit?
Joey.
Kid's right, Joe. Here. Just sign this and I'll file it when I get back to the town hall.
We just call someone or take her out into the woods or find a ravine someplace?
I feel so silly. What now?
Don't beat yourself up, Joe. It's not your fault. We need a permit to do everything nowadays. Funny thing is that nobody knows how to do the simplest things for themselves anymore. At least you're making an effort. Here, let me help.
Thanks, Mackie, but I'm not interested in a handout.
Yeah, what handout? It's not a handout. We gotta start burning gas like there's no tomorrow if we're gonna get this economy moving again. Hey, Joey, you grab the back legs, I'll grab the front.
Sure.
A one and a two and a...
Hello?
Stop where you are. Hands where I can see them.
That's Dr. Habib. He just moved in next door. He's from Egypt. Good guy, though. Hey, Doc! Nice mask!
Thanks, Joe. I got it on Etsy. How are you on this beautiful day?
All good, Doc. Who do you got there?
This was Moxie.
Poor thing. What happened? Such a weird-looking dog?
He got that lot. Mexican hairless. He was in a brawl with some chipmunks and never quite recovered.
He doesn't look wounded.
I do believe he died from shame and humiliation. He had more honor and pride in that tiny hairless body of his than a Bengal tiger. So I was going to bury him out back when I noticed poor old Muffin and this pile of brush in your yard. If it's not too much trouble, would you mind?
No problem at all. Throw him on.
Do you know, cremating dogs in the backyard has been a custom in my country since the days of the pharaohs?
Has it now?
Yes, when a pharaoh died.
Joey, come on. Let's walk and talk.
Sure, but I've got to get back to my midterm soon.
So, school good? How are your classes?
All good. I'm taking medieval calligraphy, the epistemology of ignorance, Aramaic, and zoology.
There's good money in medieval Caligula?
I don't know. I'm not really thinking about making money.
It must be nice. So, any word from your pop?
He's just holed up in the cabin working on his project.
Hard enough on a man to lose his job, but at his age, I don't know how you rebound from that. Your old man's not a quitter. He'll get through this. We all will. What project?
Who knows? He just packed up Grandma's typewriter, 20 reams of paper, and headed up to the cabin, which is bizarre because I've never seen him write anything in my whole life. I've never even seen him read anything. Nothing makes sense anymore. Dad's writing some manifesto in a cabin in the mountains, and Mom's running a crematorium.
I know. It's hard to know what's what with all the fake news.
It's not the fake news, Officer McKenzie.
Joey, don't drink the Kool-Aid. Everything from the Marxist mainstream media is fake news.
So, if I heard on NPR that the sky is blue...
Fake news.
or if I read in the New York Times that water is wet?
Not fake news.
Le Monde and the BBC?
Fake news, fake news, fake news. Joey, it's poisoned fruit from a poisoned tree. When the liberal elites shipped our jobs to China, where was the mainstream media, huh? Where were they when we threw open the doors to Mexico and said, come on in and take all the crappy jobs we have left? You have the internet. Do some research.
So what's the truth, then? Is there no such thing as objective truth or a common reality?
Truth and reality are whatever the last man standing says it is. And our guy is no quitter. And he's going to make America great again.
He's a vicious bully. He's a lying, incompetent, morally bankrupt con man.
He's not a bully, Joey. He's a fighter. The media is the real liar. He's the most competent president in history. He's not corrupt. He's draining the corrupt Washington swamp. And everybody is out to get him for it.
All you fascists,
libtards, care about is
God,
race,
guns,
gays,
and country.
Identity politics. You're young, so you don't really know, Joey. But when I was your age, we didn't have to worry about hurting people's feelings or giving everyone a trophy just for breathing or asking people for their pronouns or listening to lazy haters bitch and moan about how unfair and racist and sexist and anti-LGBTWXYZ this country is. This is the greatest country in the history of the world. You just gotta know the real... Get down! Get down! There's someone coming. Looks like they got a weapon.
That's our neighbor, Mrs. Patel. With a wheelbarrow. She's bummed out, I think. Her husband just passed.
So the whole Exodus story was actually the first fake news in history.
Sorry to cut you off, Doc, but... Hey, Miss Patel! You put that down!
Hi, Joe.
Joey, sweetheart, quit yapping with Mackie and give Miss Patel a hand, will ya?
He's got book smarts, but...
That was such a nice funeral. I'm so sorry I couldn't stay for the whole thing, but my internet crashed.
Thank you, Joe. That means a lot to me. Joe, I couldn't help but notice your pyre. If it's not too much trouble, say no more.
Hey, Mackie, could you and Joey give Miss Patel a hand with Mr. Patel?
Sure thing. Come on, Joey. Get the legs, I'll get the arms. A one, and a two, and a...
Goodbye, my love. He was a good husband, as husbands go. I just wish there wasn't so much of him. He was a bit too fond of the gulab jamun.
Gulab jamun.
I brought some petrol, too. They're practically giving it away. Oh, and I almost forgot. Here, this was delivered to my address.
It's from Dad.
Hey, Dad, we finally finished it.
Finished what? Changing our name to Kaczynski? Cool. Do we all get to go underground now? Or just you and Dad?
This is going to be big, sweetheart. This will change the narrative once and for all.
Marvelous. Do tell.
Hashtag the real Hamilton. It's a play.
Hashtag the real Hamilton. Is it a musical?
Yes, with songs.
Let me guess. It's Hamilton without rap music or black people.
This is going to be so big.
Like Birth of a Nation big?
Come on, Joey. Bigger.
Joey, everybody, sorry, but I gotta go. Some libtard's burning a flag. You guys be good. 6 feet apart. Keep that fire hot.
You got it, Mackie. Go get him. Honey, I see Jose and Bjorn coming over with their cats. Would you grab some more wood? And I think we should start the memorial.
I'll get some wood, but I can't stay for the service, Mom. I've got to get back to my midterms. But text if there's a cottage for roadkill.
See? I told you we'd get through this. Everything is fine.
Now, should we pay our respects to the dearly departed?
Yes, of course.
Oh, let's.
Old MacDonald had a farm. Yeah, and on the farm he had a
husband.
E-I-E-I-O. With a wife, a shirt here, and a wife for dinner there.
There's a one everywhere. Old MacDonald had a husband.
E-I-E-I-O. Old MacDonald had a farm. E-I-E-I-O. And on that farm he had a
dog.
E-I-E-I-O. And a woof-woof-woof here and a woof-woof there.
Next up, we've got two historians, two people I admire greatly. Fine intellect and a sensitivity that I could only wish in myself. Billy and Bob. They also have the good sense to not use their actual real names for this broadcast. So, if you hear another name besides Billy or Bob in our discussion, ignore it. I mostly just edited myself out of this conversation and just let these two guys really explore some interesting ideas. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. I started with the question, what's going on? I'm so confused, I have no idea what just happened. And Billy gamefully answers.
Wow, a big question. First of all, I think I'm going to start by saying I'm probably not going to come at this from a position of history or as a historian. So much more on my mind these days in observing this have been just really talking to a lot of people over the last 4 years and going through my own kind of metamorphosis and trying to understand why 63 million voted for Trump in 2016. And in the experience of trying to make sense of that over 4 years, I really think differently about this moment and about the confluence of events and people and experiences that have led to what seems to be some kind of political movement with a lot more staying power than I expected 5 years ago when I saw Trump rising, and that I expect is going to be around for a long time. And I think a lot of what I've been kind of thinking about and writing about recently is my frustration with people who are more likely to share my political views. I consider myself a leftist. I'm not going to define that, but I'm certainly left-wing in my politics, and that comes out of many years of becoming that. And I've faced a lot of frustration in the lead-up to this vote and in the aftermath of it, watching people I would likely agree with at times triumphant about this experience, about Biden's victory and alleged victory. He won. He got more votes, and he got more votes in the right place. But it was closer than many thought it would be. And it involved dynamics that are really worrisome if you'd like to see that type of politic defeated in the future, and I do. And those dynamics include, as I mentioned, 10 million additional votes, where those votes came from, and where, you know, one way of looking at it is Biden won on a referendum on the president's behavior. But it really didn't include, and a lot of motivated voters, really disgusted by Trump and wanting to see him lose, but it did not include a distinct vision for a politics that addresses the economic concerns that I think a growing number of people, not just in the United States, but around the world have, that's certainly related to globalism and a sense of alienation. And then things that I've really am drawn to more and more reading Josh's writing. And Josh, I think you may even be surprised by this, but I think you have an interest in how whatever's happening economically and socially also has a spiritual dimension to it that involves religion. And part of my story does come out of a background growing up in American evangelicalism. So I have a background that's certainly well connected to the largest voting bloc for Trump. And I find myself curious about that, a certain spiritual dimension to...
I think that's, and he that started in a great place. I would agree with
a lot of
everything he said.
Makes
the spiritual
kind of
dimension,
nationalism,
I think,
popular.
That's a tricky one. I mean, I would describe it maybe a little bit more as kind of a postmodern crisis of meaning in terms of thinking about history unfolding sort of in an epochal sort of way, right? Moving through kind of large stretches of time, right? And so if we go back, for example, to, you know, the Christian world and that worldview being displaced by the worldview of the Enlightenment, and then with all of its assumptions about progress, about reason, about rationality, and then seeing, you know, those ways of understanding and those ways of sort of thinking about changing the world, right, being applied in ways that people that are, you know, reprehensible. So, for example, you know, some historians have traced the Enlightenment and Enlightenment thinking to the rise of National Socialism, and have attributed some of the worst horrors of the 20th century to certain elements of Enlightenment thought. And so, you know, after the Second World War, after a dropping of atomic bombs, some of those Enlightenment assumptions about, you know, endless progress were questioned. And the other thing that was questioned along with it was the meta narrative, right? This idea that we can have or should have kind of a big explanatory story about what it's all about, right? And so philosophers and academics grasped onto this concept and called it postmodernism. It doesn't mean we're totally out of the modern era and all of its assumptions, but I think one thing that's one characteristic of this era is that questioning of absolute truth, right? It's the questioning of the big story, because big stories in the past were used as, according to, you know, some postmodernist thinkers, were used as kind of tools for oppressors against the oppressed, right? Because if there is one dominant story, it's being often used to dominate others and push out kind of marginal stories or marginalized stories. So that's a long-winded way of kind of saying, you know, the liberalism and the postmodernism of the late 20th century is sort of a vacuum. It's sort of an ethical vacuum. It's sort of a spiritual vacuum, right? It posits no kind of objective good. What it does is basically say we need to leave enough space for people to pursue their individual self-interest. It says that there is no absolute truth. It says that there is no grand or meta-narrative, and that we're all sort of creating our own individual stories and carving out our own individual meanings. You know, the slogans of the day, right? Like, you do you, right? Or I don't want to impose my ideas on somebody. Or, you know, or the, you know, basically moral relativism, right, which is often critiqued from the right. But I think the left could make a strong, should be making a strong critique of moral relativism as well. But it finds itself in this place where it doesn't have necessarily any kind of foundation on which to build an ethical or moral system. And I think increasingly the left, the far left in the United, like the socialist left in the United States, works from some of the basic assumptions of liberalism in designing an ethic or pointing to morality. And I think it falls short on that front because it doesn't, because by doing that, again, I think really what you're doing is just saying we all need the free, like, what is freedom? Freedom is just to pursue individual self-interest. And so without sort of a higher purpose or a higher calling, you know, socialism today is missing that, frankly, that kind of utopian element that it had in the 19th century, or it's missing that, you know, that Marxist element that was tied to Enlightenment assumptions about endless progress, right? That we're going to reach this almost golden age of humanity. That gave something people to, that gave people an ethic. That they gave people a sense of place in a long scheme of history. That gave people a sense of rootedness. And I don't think there's any kind of, you know, analog to that today, and I think people find them for so many other reasons. We'll talk about the economic stuff later, but people find themselves rootless, dislocated, disconnected, alienated. And I think it's a spiritual, I think you can describe it as a spiritual crisis, and with a huge economic dimension to it as well that contributes to it.
It's hard to say that the majority of Trump voters are operating out of some pursuit of self-interest. To me, it seems their self-interest takes a backseat to feeling a part of a large movement.
Isn't that the core of self-interest, to find that sense of belonging in some type of group, given that a hyper-individualism? What's more self-interested than finding that? It's different than an economic self-interest.
Yeah, I think like the Marxist idea of false consciousness, right? Like, why does the worker vote against his self-interest? It's complicated, right? There are like huge psychic rewards. There are social rewards. There's cultural connection, right? Sense of regaining sort of a sense of meaning and purpose and connection and community, and power. You know, and power, like a sense of agency in an increasingly alienated world. And I'm not trying to make it all rosy. Like, these are just people who need meaning. Like, there's a lot of, bad stuff going on there too, right? Like,
well, the Nazi Party gives you meaning too.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I would trace the long sort of history of the move towards postmodern relativism and everything. I think that lines up, over with an economic story in the big picture, right? Like someone like Thomas Piketty, who wrote Capital in the 21st Century, in 2014, basically demonstrated power will naturally tend, if left to its own devices, economic power or capital will tend to be concentrated in, fewer and fewer hands. It will tend to sort of monopolize. In that the mid-20th century, that period of prosperity was like this total anomaly. But everyone thinks like that was capitalism at its best. Well, yeah, I think it probably was. And, he's saying we're not going to get that back. Like, that's just not going to happen the way things are designed right now with the financialization of capital and how fluid it's become and how global it's become. So that's one part of it. I think the other part is, So we're looking at an increasingly unequal global economic system for the most part, right? Like, we do find, people like, what's that dude who's always rosy about everything? Steven Pinker, he makes some decent points that like actually a bunch of people in the developing world have been brought out of poverty by capitalism. And I don't think that's wrong, but we're kind of doing this. Who wrote, what's that book? The World is Flat, like Thomas Friedman, right? But like we're getting a leveling of global wages as corporations find markets in the developing world. And so, now the American worker has to compete with a worker in Bangladesh, right? It's not going to happen, right? Their wages are going to go down. So there's that part of the story. And there's also what geographer David Harvey calls neoliberalism, right? It was this term we all hear. And he describes it as a class war waged from above. That basically, after the gains of labor and social movements in the 1950s or 60s, capital went on the offensive. And they said, we need to reassert our power, our authority, our position over these movements. And they did. Right. And so, we get, strike breaking presidents like Reagan. Right. It becomes this or Margaret Thatcher. Right. And in England, we get from the 70s on this class war from above, and one of the components of it is austerity, economic austerity across the board, policies that preference free trade over social safety nets, basically the erosion of welfare states. Not like we ever had one, but, in Europe, they start to be sort of dismantled. It becomes this global phenomenon and it leads to this fact that workers' wages, real wages in the United States, have not grown in 40 years. Add that to the story, right? Like, that's a huge piece of it. So it's an economic crisis, right, for working people. The majority of people in this country don't have $400 to pay for an emergency. And people are like, well, why would someone vote for Trump? Well, why the hell do you, you know, like it's such, to me, it's the most absurd thing about some of this is how people don't understand the appeal of Trump. Like, because it's out of desperation, it's anger, it's frustration, it's dislocation, it's alienation. People are pissed, you know, and they know, and he plays on that, right? He plays on the racism. But people know what they're going to get with a Democrat for the most part, you know? They know what they're going to get. It's been tried and true. And so these are people, you know, the analogy I like to give is like, this is a person with their foot in a bear trap, right? Who's like, you know, I'm just going to saw my leg off, you know? Like, I'm going to just act out of desperation and anger and frustration for this thing. That's not the whole story. I don't mean to reduce it all to economics, right? Because the racism is real. The sexism was real in 2016. You know, all that stuff is hugely important. And you know, Biden just won, right? So Trump has lost his position of dominance. But Trumpism, and what I mean by that is, you know, right-wing populism is far from over. And the last thing I'll say, and I'll shut up for a little while, it's not a national phenomenon. You know, as Billy pointed out before, it's global, right? We have Johnson in England, you've got Bolsonaro in Brazil, we've got Trump, there's Salvini in Italy, there's a far right in Poland. The left, Hungary, the left is dead. That's the thing. The left is dead. Like, Corbyn was booted from the Labour Party. Podemos in Greece was, you know, turned into an austerity party. What's his name? Bernie Sanders. You know, he was defeated. I mean, one of the ways I'm increasingly kind of seeing this is that this was the last gasp of elements of what could have been a successful left. You know, union membership is at a historic low in the United States. You know, you can't have a vibrant socialist movement or a real left movement without a vibrant labor movement, right? Unless your conception of leftism is something that's not connected to labor. In which case, like, what are you talking about?
And I think that has been among the most discouraging parts of reading some of your writing. I don't see a lot who are saying it that explicitly, that there is no left. There is not something that captures that. And at the same time, recognizing, you know, especially the 2016 Sanders and the Brexit moment, that there did seem to be something that could have captured that. And it's been disheartening to see some of those issues around trade and the debt and international wars grabbed by the right and used, with a population was ready to hear some of those populist themes that didn't necessarily need to be right wing.
Trump's appeal in 2016 was not that he was, you know, a Republican but worse, right? Like, that wasn't it. The appeal was what you both described. It was a type of economic populism that resonates with a lot of people in the form of protectionism, right? Which the left hates to hear, but the idea of open borders is pretty abhorrent to, like, most Americans, you know? The idea that immigrants are stealing jobs is something that people believe, right? So he's got that. He talked about infrastructure. He talked about protecting Social Security. And he hit Hillary Clinton hard in 2016 on her support for the Iraq War. So it was, you know, protectionism, isolation, and populist economic policy. And I mean, he didn't take that tact so much in this election cycle. You know, I followed him on Facebook, unlike, you know, most people who are, you know, probably listening to the show, but you know, he came out hard with some stuff against Biden for you know, basically said, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a warmonger status quo. But, and he was right. You know, he was, like, right about all this stuff. But he lost the plot between 2016 and 2020. So back to your question, Kevin, what wins, right? What's the way forward out of this? I want to suggest that the Democratic Party is America's second most enthusiastic capitalist party. That being the case, I think there are inherent sort of internal structural limits on the types of policies that they will pursue. I don't think that they are without a significant groundswell from below to challenge that structure. The Republican Party is becoming the party of the working class. And they're even saying, we need to strengthen Social Security. We need to offer good health care. We need to, you know, avoid pointless wars. And the winning combination, that plus let's not go into the world of culture, right? Like, avoiding those sensitive cultural issues, I think that's the winning ticket. I think broad-based sort of class-oriented programs that have broad appeal is the way forward. So, like, that's why Sanders was so successful in 2016. And I think was, you know, it carried him through to 20 in this election cycle too. But I think he sort of lost the plot as well. Like, you know, I think he was super strong in 2016 because he was tapping into the same kind of angry energy that Trump was. And, you know, I spent a little bit of time on a picket line with some striking workers at this factory, believe it or not, they still exist in the United States. And half those guys I talked to were Sanders supporters. And then when Sanders lost, they switched to Trump. So what's that like, you know, that needs to be explained. Right. And I think it can be pretty easily. But I think that the winning path forward, let me just go back to that for a second. I think the winning path forward is broad-based, class-based, economic bread and butter issues. It's Medicare for all, it's higher wages, it's it might not even be Medicare for all, right? It's some kind of real good healthcare system. It's infrastructure, it's all that, right? It's not another politicians putting their pronouns in their Twitter bios. Right. It's not drag queen story hour. And I'm not saying those things are bad. But what I'm saying is I'm trying to be a little provocative because, like, when people think about the Democratic Party, people on the right, that's what they associate it with. They think about cultural intrusion. They think about cultural dislocation. They're not seeing the policies that they would benefit from. They're not seeing economic uplift. What they're seeing is essentially a culture war. And they're the victims of it. They're the backwards, hillbilly, dumb Christians who get the ire of the coastal elite. That stuff doesn't resonate with people. You know, it's not going to win votes. So I think the party that can do that is the party that's going to win. And it's quite possible the Republican Party could be the one to do that. I don't think there's a left in this country anymore. I think it's been kind of subsumed with identitarian liberalism to the point where, it's not a really existing force. And because I think the characteristics of that left would be it's rooted in the working class. That's not true, right? The left isn't really connected to the working class anymore. And it would be capable, and I think this is the really key point, a real left would be capable of organizing the working class. The left in this country, however we define that, does not organize the working class. What it does is that it activates an already existing base, right? So it's more about, you know, people getting people out in the streets with signs and bullhorns, right? It's activating and moralizing. Those are the two things that the left does. It activates the existing base and moralizes. What it needs to do more of is find broad programs that will have broad appeal across the working class that can bridge those divides between, you know, the Sanders voter and the Trump voter. So that's what I think needs to happen. I don't think it will happen.
Well, I wanted to mention where that dynamic plays out is that it allow that if the Democratic Party is a party that is not connected and cannot speak for the working class, and however you define that, then the hypocrisy becomes so obvious to that other part of the voting coalition that could go the other way. That's it just becomes very clear. And so that's where you get the mockery of the lifestyles of the rich and democratic while at the same time seeming to claim that they really speak for the marginalized. And it just, those hypocrisies really resonate.
It's important to note, right, when we say the working class, I think we have to be careful, all right, that, you know, the working class is multiracial, right? And the working class is You know, our image of like the white guy with the hard hat, you know, that's not the base of the working class anymore. You know, it's a home, you know, it's a Latina home health aide, right? Like that's it. It's a very, you know, mixed demographics. And, you know, that the black and brown section of the working class, they're very much Democrat, right? So I think that's important to remember. You know, I think it's also important to remember that in 2016, those with lower household incomes voted more often for Hillary Clinton. So, you know, it's not totally that the working class has gone to the Republicans. I don't think that's the case. One of the other important parts of this story is that when we talk about, you know, the people most on the margins, black, white, everybody, they don't vote, you know? Like they're not even part of the, they should be the center of the story in many ways, because they're looking at all this and they're saying, does my life is still going to be this, right? No matter who is in charge. So there are people, and there's other, of course, there's, you know, voter suppression is real. You know, there are many different factors that lead to that low voter turnout. And it's not to say, oh, these people have some, like, you know, possess some innate intelligence and that we don't have, right? That makes them, you know, choose not to participate or something. But I think it's revealing. It's very telling.
And just the way votes count. I mean, as someone living in California, meeting very well-informed voters who don't vote, because it doesn't really play a role, in a decisive role in that state. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you guys a question. Billy, you mentioned the kind of the economic type, pursuing economic, you know, an economic agenda, basically, right, for the uplift of the many. One of the critiques that I continue to hear of taking that approach, which is very, you know, class-based, is that it leaves people behind, right? That it's suggesting that you push cultural or social issues to the margins, which, you know, is harmful for already marginalized people. So, you know, sort of failing to center cultural issues is potentially harmful to those folks. What do you think about that?
I came out of Appalachia. I was raised to be a Trump voter. I was supposed to be like everybody else that I read now. That doesn't go past me that I was. And so what's the difference? One is I've had tens of thousands of dollars of federal aid and education that got me to a place that took years and years and years to think differently about the world. And travel experiences and so forth, but they were, something emerges out of the fortune of, and it shouldn't be a fortune, it should be a right of education. And so I do look at these, I look at classmates, I look at family members, and I know their backgrounds. And it's important to remember that as a nation, we have undermined public education year after year after year, and that has an impact. In a moment like this, it doesn't make you any less frustrated when you hear these ideas that have no evidence or warrant behind them, that don't seem to have a logic. But when I think back on my own experience, and we just don't even unpack that ourselves very often, but it takes years of education and schools and teachers who actually care about that to cultivate in a population some of the ways of interpreting data that are necessary for democracy, ways of understanding science, ways of thinking about learning, ways of valuing it. And for little tweaks here and there, I went in that direction. And I don't feel like it was just inevitable. I think a lot of lucky breaks happened for me that got me in that path. So it does cause me to think about that when I listen to someone talk about. And again, I want to go back to what I was saying before, is I don't believe it's our job to disabuse people of their beliefs and to have these debates and discussions as though we're going to convert somebody. But I do think it's important to listen, because like good portion of the post-industrialized world is moving in a particular direction, and we need to know why it's doing that and respond with economic programs that really resonate, that stick to that, that really are focused on improving everyday lives and helping people feel like they're agents of those lives. So those are different kinds of programs, and creating jobs that come as close as possible to making people feel meaning and connection and belonging. All I know, the one thing I, you know, when people have educations and jobs that feel sustainable and meaningful, they think differently about the political world. They vote differently. So it obviously has some kind of impact. It seems like that would be a reasonable direction to go if you want, again, if your most modest goal is to try to marginalize xenophobic nationalism and authoritarianism. A town that I grew up in was a small town in North Carolina. I look back at the statistics of it. In 1970, and I was born a year before that, it was 1% Hispanic, and it had 10,000 people in that town. By 1990, it had 25,000, and it was 35% Hispanic. All of the kind of chicken processing plants had closed by then, or were obviously the workforce was replaced by really Central Americans who were invited there to be part of this new workforce. So if you're growing up in that town, it's a town where I grew up, and you look at what the major changes of your life are, you're 50 years old in 1990 or 2000, you look back at your whole life, the big changes are economic, what you do for a living, what's happened to the town. You see demographic change. You see educational opportunity, really moving many of the brighter kids to the capital cities or to Atlanta or Charlotte. And I think that's where those things tie together. If those are your major experiences with both culture and economics being the dominant trends in your of how your life is different than it was 30, 40, 50 years previous, I think those connections are easy for a politician to come in and link them together, even without making it explicit. And I think that's where some of those linkages might exist. I mean, the biggest bank in my town was locally owned. It's gone now. It's obviously been replaced. And you could do that for all kinds of different companies. Telecommunications company was locally owned. My father worked for the phone company, and it was a local phone company. That now, if you wanted the equivalent job that he has, you need to move to San Francisco and work for Verizon. We've been talking about working class, but those are white collar jobs. And they're being funneled to very small subset of cities. You look at where most of the economic growth in the last 20 years has been, it's really concentrated in 300 metropolitan areas. And even among those, a high percentage in like 20 of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely a part of the story, and I think, you know, implied there, right? It's maybe worth saying, we haven't said it, it's just been implied that a lot of middle class jobs have disappeared over the last 60 years, right? And many of them were in manufacturing, and there was a time when more people could support a family on a single income, etc. I'm looking at a book on my shelf right now. It's called Main Street Blues by this guy, sociologist. Last name is Davies, and if I'm remembering it right, basically he describes in the late 19th century the rise of mass culture, the rise of national newspapers, and the really kind of like an early brain drain from the countryside to the cities that created something like, you know, an urban-rural divide, right? And so like, it's not totally new in American history, right? But I think the difference now is that back then there was a burgeoning sort of mass culture, national mass culture, and it's really come to fruition, right? With like the Walmartification of everything. You drive through across the country on I-90, you know, you pull off in any given exit, and they all look the same, right? You're looking at the same strip malls, the same Applebee's, the same homogenous wasteland of corporate crap. But that killed the small town or whatever, and it killed, you know, local regional culture. But now that that mass national culture is breaking down, you know, and you've got your New York Times readers and their, you know, elite educated enclaves, and you've got the Fox News watchers in this other part of the country. So there's like almost like a new cultural regionalism, maybe, that's developing, right? And it's leading to, it's helping to facilitate some of the disconnect, the fragmentation we're talking about. And people live in these bubbles, you know? And I think, like, you know, the educated, coastal, liberal, professional, managerial class person doesn't think they do. I really don't think they do think that, right? I think they think that they have an objective, sound, rational view of the world, and everything should conform to it.
We go back to the idea that this is a party that's flailing because it doesn't have an economic agenda. I mean, the stuff on Russia, that was something I agreed with Bob on early on, was the emphasis on Russia over and over and over just sent a message also that we care about something that no working American really seems to be caring. I don't want to say working, but an entire subset of the population just didn't care. The suggestion all along was he wouldn't have gotten elected otherwise. And I think by now, I hope we've disabused ourselves of that notion, that Trumpism is powerful enough to get elected. And by the way, I just want to point out that Stephen Bannon is not—he's not someone crusading for vote recounts and so forth. He believes that Trumpism or some version of this can win with massive majorities in the future. He would have had Trump putting together a massive works project prior to this, and that's scary to think if he had gotten that done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think the more competent Trump is the thing to fear. But I guess I wonder what that means, right? Like, more competent in which Trump and in what ways, right? Like, I think of course, if it's the racism, if it's the xenophobia, if it's the limiting of, you know, the rights of LGBT people, if it's the Trump of the social cultural war, I think we should all fear that, right? But I wonder if in the Republican Party there's a place for a new type of compassionate conservatism, you know, that might be actually more compassionate. I don't know. I don't think so. I really, really don't think so. But the way that Marco Rubio and some others are talking right now, I really wonder if they can hit that combination. One of the periods in history that I tend to connect this us to more and more is, you know, people have drawn comparisons between the Roman Empire and the United States. I feel like we're more in the late Republic, late Roman Republic, where they had a values crisis, they had a land and economic crisis, and it culminated in decades of civil war, right, before basically an emperor or dictator took power. So, I mean, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but we do get some echoes, and I think we're facing similar economic and values crisis that is very hard to resolve.
Sing another song, sing it with the spirit that will start the world along. Sing it as we used to sing it 50,000 strong while we were marching to Georgia. Georgia. Yes, and there were unions. with joyful tears. When they saw the honored flag they had not seen for years, hardly could they be restrained from breaking forth in cheers. While we were marching